You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. Before you do anything right now, if you're not driving, I would encourage you to just hit pause, go to wherever you get
pull over.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Pull over.
Pull over right this minute.
Now.
And if you wouldn't mind, pretty please, cherry on top, go and pre-order the book, Love Matters More, How Fighting to Be Right Keeps Us from Loving Like Jesus. My goal, I'll tell you straight up, my goal is to sell enough copies that they let me write another one. That's it. That's the goal I have. So help help me be able to write more books. But no, honestly, I think this book, for me, the message that Love Matters More couldn't come at a better time. And as we get some feedback from people who have read the first chapter, which you can get free at lovemattersmorebook.com, the feedback we're getting is that this is really helpful during this time of being able to talk about things that we fundamentally disagree with our friends and family in a way that's still loving, and how love matters more than pretty much everything else. So I would encourage you, if you can, do it now before the book comes out September 8th. It helps us. Go to lovemattersmorebook.com or just go straight to wherever you buy books and order it.
Yeah.
All right. What are we talking about today, Pete?
Our readers have done this before. They've ordered books.
That's
right. They know how to do this, right? Yeah. Okay. Anyway, hey, folks, very excited about today's interview. The topic is telling the truth about Jesus's wife. Yeah, you heard that right. Our, sort of sounds weird, but of course the podcast will clarify that. But our guest today is Ariel Sabar. He is an award-winning investigative journalist, and I like that, investigative journalist. And he's written stuff for like Washington Post, New York Times, and The Atlantic. And he put out a book that just came out recently called Veritas. Veritas, by the way, is the motto for Harvard, which is really sort of important here. There's a double meaning. But Veritas, a Harvard professor, a con man, and the gospel of Jesus's wife. So that's pretty cool, huh, Jared?
Yeah, I like that he's an investigative journalist, because it felt like we were talking to like a detective or something throughout the episode, which was really intriguing and cool. I felt like I was in a Dan Brown novel or something. But yeah, I think
what was he investigating? What was he investigating?
So it's this interesting story, and I asked my wife about it after we had recorded with Ariel. You know, do you remember this idea or this thing floating around that Jesus had a wife? And she said, yeah, I kind of remember that. I was like, well, we kind of interviewed the guy who was like at the heart of that story. And she was really impressed. So yeah, it's kind of figuring out, it's all these clues, but it's also bigger than that, which is why I think we were interested in interviewing Ariel, because it really has to do with truth finding. And for those of us who grew up thinking that historical accuracy of the Bible was kind of central, we get into that and we talk about, well, what does that mean? And how do you find those truths? And what happens when things kind of go sideways?
And it's also about just the world of in this case, biblical scholarship. And yeah, I mean, in today's world, Jared, there's a lot of distrust about experts.
Right.
You know, elite experts, and they don't know what you can't trust and can't trust them. And what safeguards what experts do is usually some form of being accountable to other experts. And when that process is followed, it helps to say, it's never perfect, but it helps to safeguard the integrity of the scholarly pursuit. But the whole point is that in this case, it wasn't followed.
Right.
Right. And that's exactly what Ariel was investigating. And you know, he tells a story at the beginning, so he explains it all. And then we get into some of the nuts and bolts of it. And it's, you know, it relates to biblical studies directly, because biblical scholars are basically, trained biblical scholars are historians. That's basically what they are. They're trying to talk about what happened, when did it happen, who wrote it, why did they write it, what's the meaning of this text, not for me today in my life, but for back then. Yeah, it's just a lot of interesting stuff and a lot of angles on this.
Yeah, well, I'm getting excited all over again, so I think we should just jump into the conversation.
I know. It was really fun to do this interview and to have a journalist on. It was great.
All right, let's get into it.
One person reading a gospel text in the 6th century may read it in a completely different way than someone reading it today. And that's okay. You can go to that same text and draw some completely different meanings from it. And on some level, each of those meanings, at least in my view, is valid. I think what's dangerous is when a theoretical way of encountering texts is also used for historical investigation.
Well, welcome to the episode, Ariel. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So we have an interesting story to hear about, just a fascinating tale of biblical scholarship and intrigue and investigative journalism. Can you give us just the 3 to 5 minute synopsis so we can get a grasp on the characters of this interesting story?
Yeah, sure. How journalists made a biblical scholar look bad.
Oh, well.
I have a sense that's very, very, I don't even know why we have you on. This is very threatening to me personally, because you might find out something that I did wrong.
Well, and I would just, you know, I think the purpose of the book isn't to make a biblical scholar look bad.
I know, of course,
it's to tell, I think, a really interesting story. And then the story begins back, in terms of the public version of the story, begins back in September of 2012, when a distinguished professor at the Harvard Divinity School, a woman named Dr. Karen Kinn, goes to Rome for the 10th International Annual Congress for Coptic Studies. So Coptic is basically the language of Egypt's earliest Christians. It is a language in which some of the earliest surviving copies of the Gospels survive. And every 4 years, the top scholars of Coptic gather in some interesting place. Sometimes it's Egypt, sometimes it's Rome. This time it was Rome, actually at a fraternal order right across from the Vatican. And she makes a presentation that has a sort of kind of a bland title. It's something like a new Coptic gospel fragment. And so, you know, everyone in the room was like, oh, this could be interesting, or it could be like a lot of the presentations we hear every 4 years, where there's some small fragment of, you know, the Gospel of John, one of the Gospels that where there are a lot of relatively large number of surviving copies. It's always interesting, but you know, they don't expect the bombshell that's about to drop, because there's no sort of forewarning. And the bombshell that drops, Karen King's paper that she gives at the conference, is about this very small scrap of papyrus. It's about the size of a business card. And papyrus, for those who don't know, it's sort of an ancient writing surface made of the dried and pressed leaves of a plant that used to grow alongside the Nile in Egypt, and on which, again, many of the earliest surviving copies of the Gospels are written. So she has a little fragment that she's discovered with 8 lines of Coptic on the front. And sort of the bombshell line, the showstopper, is the very, very middle line in which Jesus is said to utter the words, "My wife." The line itself says, Jesus said to them, quote, "My wife." And this is, you know, this is important. You know, Karen King does not make the claim that the fragment has any value as sort of biography. She's not making the claim that this fragment tells us that the historical Jesus was married. But what she does claim is that sometime in the second century, you know, within 200 years of Jesus's life, there was a group of Christians somewhere who believed that Jesus had a wife. And that would still be historic, because there are no surviving manuscripts from antiquity that present this version of a married Jesus. And in her interpretation, and the woman that Jesus is described as being married to in this fragment is Mary Magdalene. And so we have this. We have the fourth line that says, Jesus said to them, "My wife." In the fifth line, it appears as though Jesus continues to speak about Mary Magdalene. He says, "She is able to be my disciple." Then Jesus appears to curse people who are effectively dissing his wife, sort of questioning her worthiness to be a disciple. And then he says that in sort of the last surviving line that essentially that I live with her, that I dwell with her. So if there's sort of any doubt about whether this is, you know, a human wife or something more spiritual, the claim to sort of be dwelling with her suggests that this is a human Mary, rather than, say, you know, the church or something. This is Karen King's interpretation.
Yeah. So Ariel, yeah. This is across the street from the Vatican.
Correct.
And she's claiming to have this manuscript, the size of a broken up manuscript, the sentences are complete, that claims that Jesus had a wife, and it was Mary, and also a disciple.
Right, that his wife was able to be, not only was Mary Magdalene, and this is, again, Karen King's interpretation, you know, she's a very learned scholar, she's, you know, sort of at the top of her field, she holds the oldest endowed professorship in all the United States, like in any subject. So very distinguished scholar, very, sort of a dazzling interpreter of sort of non-canonical scripture, scripture that did not make the New Testament. And so this would certainly fall into that category if it were authentic. And so in her reading, what we have here is a dialogue between Jesus and the disciples, the disciples begin by sort of suggesting that there's a controversy over Mary. There's a controversy over Mary is worthy of discipleship. And Jesus responds by telling them two things. He says, my wife. And then he says, she is able to be my disciple. So sort of in sort of very quick succession, this papyrus sort of, I mean, read in a certain way, demolishes two of the central pillars of sort of Catholic tradition. One is that Jesus was a lifelong celibate bachelor. Number two is that he did not select women among his sort of closest followers, among the 12, certainly.
So then we have this fragment, and I, one of the things that was intriguing to me when I was reading through your book was I remember this becoming kind of a shockwave through at the time as someone who was studied in religious schools and all these other things. This was definitely something that came across my news feed, so to speak. I don't know if there were news feeds back 8 years ago. I don't know what's happening 8 years ago. But, this came across my desk, so to speak, and thought it was really interesting. But what I think is the kind of the twist of the story is it didn't turn out to be what we all maybe thought it was. So can you maybe finish the rest of that story? Because I have some questions about the process of truth-telling and how we figure out the authenticity of these kinds of things.
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, I was on assignment for Smithsonian Magazine back in 2012. The Smithsonian, which is the magazine affiliated with the Smithsonian Institutions here in D.C., you know, they have a famous magazine. They cover a lot of scholarship, sort of everything from science to history. And they had gotten sort of a heads up that this was coming. So they assigned me a feature story, and they sent me to see Dr. King in Harvard sort of a few weeks before her big announcement. And then they also sent me to Rome. And so I was actually the only reporter in the room when she makes this announcement to colleagues. And I described this sort of really remarkable scene in the room when she presents her paper where, you know, almost really instantly in the Q&A after her 20-minute talk, her 20-minute paper, the top scholars in Coptic and in the sort of non-canonical Gospels who are in the room immediately are like have a lot of questions. Like there's almost instantaneous serious doubt about the fragment, and you know I think the first problems became evident the moment the scholars saw photos of the papyrus. Now interestingly, Karen King said that her computer had broken down on the way to Rome, and so she wasn't able to show photographs. Which upset a lot of the scholars in the room, because when you're looking at when you're judging the authenticity of a manuscript, you really have to physically see it, because it's in the
you have to look at it. Yeah,
you have to look at the handwriting. You have to look at the application of the ink. You have to look at the condition of the papyrus itself. You know, King is a textual scholar. She's interested in what sort of the message is. What does the text say? But when you're evaluating authenticity, you really have to look at the material aspects of a manuscript. And because we are now sort of in the connected age, some of the scholars who had like iPads and laptops were able to get online and notice that even before they were presented with images of the papyrus, the rest of the world were being shown those images via the media. Harvard had given images to, you know, not only Smithsonian Magazine, my story was up almost instantaneously, but also the New York Times and the Boston Globe. And so they start going on their phones, their iPads, and even during her presentation are seeing images of the papyrus for the first time. And what they're seeing is disconcerting. They're seeing handwriting, Coptic handwriting that looks like no other ancient Coptic handwriting they've seen. The look of the ink is a little funny. They're noticing grammatical and spelling errors in the Coptic that don't look like grammatical and spelling errors that a native speaker in antiquity would have made. And there's also the shape of the fragment. It's like it's almost perfectly rectangular. And if you know anything about the surviving pieces of papyrus that have managed to survive the hundreds of years of history, they're usually pretty ragged. I mean, I describe them in the book as looking like, you know, sort of the jagged coastline of a country. There's not really any symmetry to them. And so it's sort of suspiciously rectangular, and you've got that sort of showstopper phrase billboarded dead center in the papyrus. So those are even within the first few hours, you have the top people in her field, her own colleagues who are asking some pretty sharp questions about the papyrus.
So my wife was like almost literally the centerpiece of this fragmentary text. And again, if I'm hearing you right, Ariel, there is enough written there in this text to suggest things, but in and of itself, it's really not clear what it's saying.
Right, and that's part of the genius of it, in a way. I think we're going to get into the issue of the forgery in a second. But it's really like, I mean, I think I describe it in the book as kind of like a Mad Lib or kind of a Rorschach test, where because the fragment is missing all of its margins, we don't know if it were an authentic text. So the presumption is because it's missing all of its margins, it's essentially resected from the broken off from the center of some much larger page, which itself was part of some larger codex or ancient book. So we don't know what comes before it. We don't know what comes after it. We don't even know necessarily how each of the lines begins and ends. So that leaves a lot of room for interpretation. And it really, what's the genius of this is that if we presume it's a forgery, and again, I know we're going to get to this more later on, but if we presume it's a forgery, which is now, sort of almost really unanimous among scholars, what the genius is that depending on which scholar you give it to, you're going to get a very different interpretation of what precisely is being said.
Yes.
Right. Well, let's get to that, the forgery part of the story, because I think that's where questions about truth and process, and I think connections to what we're seeing in our day and age around media and what gets shared and what gets authenticated, I think there's some clear parallels here.
Sure. So, there's this initial wave of questions, and I think, what was interesting is that this having broken in kind of 2012, it was a period in which a lot of scholarship and scholarly discussion was moving online. So in the past, you'd have this glacial process where, a scholar would take many months to publish their article in a peer-reviewed journal, then it would take another year for scholars to respond in sort of a civilized way to the arguments that the first scholar was making. And now, because of the blogosphere and the fact that a lot of young scholars are taking to the blogosphere, you had like this very robust online debate where everyone was kind of all these scholars from young upstart grad students to more experienced scholars were weighing in kind of in real time, kind of crowdsourcing scholarship, trying to figure out what was really going on with this fragment. And at the beginning, there was some debate, and one of the first real breakthroughs in trying to figure out what might have happened here was there's a scholar in the UK named Francis Watson was looking at this, and he's like, a lot of these phrases look a lot like the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas is a non-canonical text, 114, sort of a list of 114 secret, what were called secret sayings of Jesus. Some scholars think it's like as early as the first century, others think it's later than that. But it's a very well-known non-canonical text. And it struck Dr. Watson that a lot of the phrases looked a lot like the Gospel of Thomas, except they were out of order. And so what he was able to do within about 3 or 4 days is by parsing the phrases on the Gospel of Jesus' wife, he was more or less able to determine that that you could basically compose the entirety of the Gospel of Jesus' wife by cutting sort of or cherry picking phrases from the Gospel of Thomas and then putting them in a new order on the Gospel of Jesus' wife, sort of to say something new that sounded like something old. And the only words that one could not extract from the Gospel of Thomas were the Coptic words, my wife. And so that was like a real breakthrough. That it looked like this was sort of a cut and paste job. Someone who knew enough Coptic to be able to sort of reverse engineer a Coptic text, possibly from an English translation of the Gospel of Thomas. So that was sort of the first big breakthrough in the scholarly detective story.
That's fascinating. How does this breakthrough cut through the noise of, you said it's kind of crowdsourcing. Is it that there's a small group of people, did Professor Watson send this to a small group of colleagues, or how did that kind of start to spread?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So I think Dr. Watson initially posted it on his own website, and then it got circulated by other scholars, including Dr. Mark Goodacre, another New Testament scholar whose blog, NT blog, mm-hmm. served as kind of a forum for a lot of the debate over the Gospel of Jesus' wife. So it sort of made it out that way. And then I think the next real breakthrough was, so you have this initial thesis that, this is a cut and paste from the Gospel of Thomas. Well, people said, you know, that's a little too easy because, you know, that presumes forgery and then works backward to prove it. And that's not good enough. And so the next real breakthrough comes with an independent scholar, a guy working out of his basement in Portland, Oregon, has only a master's degree from Oxford, really smart guy, never held a job as an academic, but has this really good nose for detail and has always been interested in sort of what's going on in online biblical scholarship. And because he's paying attention to the kinds of things that everybody's posting online about biblical scholarship and various idiosyncratic translations of, you know, non-canonical texts that are popping up all over the internet, he starts looking at this papyrus scrap. His name is Andrew Bernhard. I hadn't mentioned that. He starts looking at the papyrus scrap, and he's noticing that there's some of the Coptic. Clearly, the Coptic is coming from the Gospel of Thomas, but there's a kind of like a typo. There's a place where something isn't perfectly transcribed from the Gospel of Thomas. Like a certain letter is missing. And it strikes him that there's really only one sort of internet translation or interlinear translation of the gospel of the Coptic Gospel of Thomas that exists online. And so an interlinear translation, some of your readers may be familiar with this, some people like to use it in Bible study. It's a translation in which you have one line of scripture in its original text, whether it's Greek or Coptic, and then immediately below it or above it, you'll have the same line in translation. And sometimes it's like you'll see word for word what Greek word or what Coptic word connects to what English word. So Andrew Bernhard's aware that there's exactly one Coptic version of, interlinear version of the Gospel of Thomas that exists online. And he goes to that version of the Gospel of Thomas. It's a PDF that a computer programmer, hobbyist, biblical scholar living in Michigan posted online back in 2002. And he goes to it and he notices that this PDF that this guy puts up has the same typo as the Gospel of Jesus' wife. Mm-hmm. So this typo does not exist in the actual Gospel of Thomas. This computer programmer living in Michigan had a transcription error in his TypeScript, of a Coptic TypeScript. And somehow this transcription error recurs in the Gospel of Jesus' wife. So that's really the first sort of smoking gun that...
And it's not a common kind of... error.
It's not a common kind of error.
It's so unusual that it really is hard not to connect those two.
It's hard not to, precisely. Right? I wouldn't say it was the final nail in the coffin, but it was a very clean shot.
The hammer is up in the air and the nail's about to go in. We're getting closer.
We're getting closer. It's not right, enough, yeah. But that was the first real, it's not only to say, well, where did this come from, but what source... What 21st century source material might a forger have consulted to produce the Gospel of Jesus' wife? Mm.
So then what was that nail in the coffin? Is there a third big piece that came out?
Yeah, so the next big piece concerns another fragment of papyrus that was provided to Dr. Karen King by the same anonymous collector. And that was a fragment of the Gospel of John. Karen King had referred to it sort of obliquely in some of her talks, but she also never released a photograph of it. People just assumed, well, okay, the Gospel of John bit, that's got to be authentic. Clearly, this guy, this collector, what he was probably trying to do was by sort of associating this one sensational papyrus with other sort of legitimate, authentic papyri, he was kind of creating kind of an aura of legitimacy.
And sure, yeah.
I mean, the Gospel of John, yeah, it's got to be real. That no problem. The thing is, when the first images came out of the Gospel of John, and they weren't from Dr. King, they were from some scientists who were conducting ink tests, who just put out the images in a sort of informal report. Scholars took a look at the Gospel of John, and within about an hour, they noticed that every single one of the 17 line breaks in this papyrus fragment mirrored a line break in another online transcript of the Coptic Gospel of John. So it was essentially the same MO. It was someone who had access to the internet, someone knew where to look for online editions of authentic Coptic papyri, and then essentially mimicked them, hoping that nobody would notice. And a scholar named Christian Askeland has his PhD from Cambridge, who at the time was associated with the Museum of the Bible, run by the Evangelical Green family, owners of Hobby Lobby. He was part of their scholars initiative. He notices right away that this thing is a 100% ripoff of this very easily accessible PDF, another PDF online of the Coptic of John. And like instantaneously, like every single scholar in the world was like, yeah, this Gospel of John, there's zero question that it's a forgery. Okay, and so what scholars, you know, now have is that they have a 100% forgery in the presence of a very dubious, likely forgery. And when you have like more than one, when you have the same collector who's presenting you one like outright forgery and one very dubious manuscript, and that second manuscript basically has the same handwriting as the definite forgery, that presents a real problem. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the lay of the land at the point at which sort of I come back into the story 3 years after Karen King's announcement in Rome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's stop there for a second, because sure. I want to go back to say, where was the breakdown in Karen? Because so there's this interesting story about a potential forgery, but you have this pretty eminent scholar.
Yeah, how did it happen?
Who right. is presenting this at a conference well before this stuff happens. How did it, like, what would be the normal process to make sure that this thing doesn't happen? And why wasn't that followed in this case?
I mean, that's a really good question and something I break down in a lot of detail through my investigative reporting in the book. A lot of that process, people are going to read about for the first time in the book, and happy to go over some of it here. You know, the way in academia, the way that this works is the process of peer review. And peer review typically is double blind. That means that the author of the article, a paper for a journal, doesn't know who's going to be peer reviewing their article, and the peer reviewers don't know who the author is. And that allows sort of the free exchange of information and free of fear or favor. And you know, Dr. King had submitted her article to the Harvard Theological Review. It's a preeminent journal in the field, peer reviewed journal. And the editors of the peer review are also Harvard Divinity School professors. Some might argue that sort of in itself is sort of a conflict of interest, because you have colleagues at the same institution editing other colleagues' work, but it's not unprecedented. And the Harvard Theological Review editors send out Dr. King's article to three peer reviewers. And two out of the three peer reviewers come back with unfavorable reviews, essentially saying, you would be very embarrassed to publish this, you know, number one. Number two, there are numerous tells of forgery, you know, everything ranging from the handwriting to the grammar to the copying from Gospel of Thomas to the very suspicious fact that the anonymous owner is not named anywhere. So, you know, the peer reviewers, and at the time they were anonymous, I'm able to identify them through the investigative reporting. They spoke to me for the book. But, you know, the Harvard Theological Review did the right thing in sending Dr. King's article pre-publication and pre her announcement to the very top scholars in the world. These are secular scholars. You know, these aren't like people associated with the Vatican, people who sort of had an agenda one way or the other about canonical versus non-canonical gospels. These are the top scholars at secular universities who are sort of the all-in-one experts in Coptic, in the so-called Gnostic Gospels or non-canonical Gospels, and in the manuscripts on which they are written. These aren't sort of, you know, hacks. And they come back, two out of the three come back and say, don't do this. So the immediate effect of that is that the Harvard Theological Review says, sorry, Dr. King, we are not going to be able to publish this right away, and we're going to need a little more homework on this, essentially. You're going to need to do some scientific testing. And one of the things Dr. King did not do before the public announcement was any scientific testing. And that also raised a lot of questions, is why not do a little bit of scientific testing to see whether, you know, the papyrus is old enough, to see whether the ink is authentic, those kinds of things. So the Harvard Theological Review was spooked enough by these early reviews to say, you know, let's hit the pause button here. Let's take a little bit more time. Although, having said that, Dr. King did not feel that she should sort of wait on the announcement. She felt that, I think she felt in her words that, you know, if she didn't sort of make it public, that it would leak out, and she'd rather just sort of put it out there. So that's sort of how it got into the public domain, even though you had two really big peer reviewers saying, don't do it.
But she put it out there not as, here's a possible, you know, a text that we might have to consider. She did she put it out there as more at least a demonstrable proof that there was a community of Christians who assumed that Jesus had a wife.
Well, this was the question, you know, again, before any of this really hit, I went up to Harvard about two or three weeks before her public presentation, and I asked her just this question because I think the day, actually, it was very interesting timing, bizarre coincidence. As a reporter, I was glad I was there to sort of record how it sort of went down. But I met her for dinner like the night after she just got back one of these really tough peer reviews, and she was clearly shaken. And you know, I said, look, I mean, what is it going to? I mean, are you going to sort of wait and do some more testing? Like, what are the chances you're going to go forward in Rome? Like, are you willing to go forward on like a 50-50% confidence that it's accurate, like 70-30? Like, what's the threshold of confidence you need in its authenticity? And she's like, oh, no. I mean, 50-50 wouldn't cut it. 70-30 doesn't cut it. It has to be a very, very, very high threshold of confidence. And so I guess, you know, the question that one wonders now is like, how did she sort of reach that level of very, very high level of confidence in spite of these negative reviews? And I think what Dr. King would tell you is that, well, you know, she consulted like a linguist who told her that, you know, essentially that some of the critiques that one of the peer reviewers raised, you know, they were legitimate, but if she put a little bit more language sort of accounting for them in her article, she'd be okay. And I think she went to people whose views would support her position, and there weren't many, but there were some, and she went to them and then addressed the peer reviews in a revision of the article. And I think in her mind she had addressed the criticism of the peer reviewers.
Yeah, so you know, I can't help but draw parallels to today, where we crowdsource all kinds of truths politically and otherwise. And it kind of spooks me to say, here's someone who was steeped in the process, who knew the value of it, who said, I would need to be 80%, 90% confident before I spoke before a panel about this finding, and had this feeling, apparently she had a feeling that she had a high degree of confidence, kind of skipped over a few steps in the process. And then it just like, what hope do we have for kind of having these gut feelings and being right when there is this clear process for truth finding? And I would just be curious, what did you learn through this process as a journalist looking in at another field's process of truth finding? Mm. What did you learn about truth and accuracy and that sort of thing?
Look, I would never claim to have all the answers, and that's a big question. But I think one of the things that fascinated me as a larger theme was what do we mean by what does truth mean in the context of religion? That was sort of a big question that I was sort of wrestling with just as a journalist, someone who's interested in how different groups of professionals and believers understand the nature of truth. And as a journalist, I'm an empiricist in the sense that I believe that there are facts out there. I believe that, you know, picking up the phone, talking to people, looking at historical records, talking to people who are experts in their field, you know, knocking on doors, that there's a process one can follow to arrive at a sort of a set of verifiable facts. You know, we may not always get the facts wrong. We may have to make some corrections along the way, but ultimately we're moving in the direction of obtaining a set of sort of discernible factual reality. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, people of faith, certainly people of devout faith, don't always, you know, in their own lives, in their own spiritual lives, certainly don't always need to have scientific proof for certain kinds of truth. That's what faith is, right? You take things sort of sight unseen because you believe that there's sort of a higher power that's a kind of guarantor of certain truths. And then there's another category that I would put Dr. King and many other scholars in. In fact, I studied this myself in college, of a kind of a postmodern approach to truth. And postmodernists don't believe in the idea of an objective reality, that essentially that we all have our own truths, and that it's a simplified way of putting it, but that whatever group has sort of the power to tell and sell the best narrative creates reality. That reality doesn't exist independently of language. So that when we tell a story, that's the reality. There's nothing sort of independent of that. And it's an important sort of, I think, as a means of interpreting literature, as a means of interpreting literary text, there's value in it, because it's true that, you know, one person reading a gospel text in you know, the sixth century may read it in a completely different way than someone reading it today. And that's okay. Like, you can go to that same text and draw some completely different meanings from it. And on some level, each of those meanings, at least in my view, is valid. I think what's dangerous is when a sort of theoretical way of encountering texts is also used for historical investigation. So yes, are there many, many meanings one can draw from a Bible verse? Certainly. It means different things to different peoples and different contexts and different parts of the world. That's great. Where I think folks get into trouble is when they use that same approach of we all have our own truths to whether a papyrus fragment is genuinely ancient or not. I think there's only one answer. It's either ancient or it isn't.
Right.
This fragment is either part of a larger page of an ancient codex or it wasn't. And I think there's a little bit of slippage. And I think that comes across towards the end of the book when I try to figure out how these different ways of knowing, how the way journalists and many scholars approach history, the way people of faith think about the nature of truth, and then the way, you know, postmodern theorists conceptualize truth. And then what happens when these different ways of truth seeking sort of collide in the same institution, and then sometimes even in the same individual. And I think that one of the things that struck me was Harvard Divinity School as an institution. Harvard is the only, I believe, it's the only one of the elite sort of schools that where there is not a freestanding Department of Religious Studies on campus. So All you've got is the Divinity School, and the Divinity School essentially is where all the expertise in religious studies lies. But the Divinity School also has a mission of training ministers. And there have been many scholars, sort of new recruits to the Divinity School who have been very uncomfortable with that mix, that the pursuit of theological truths needs to be separated from sort of the secular investigation of what people do when they talk about religion.
So, you know, one of the, we talk about different kinds of truth on this podcast, and we talk about like fact truths versus meaning truths. Mm-hmm. And that meaning truth is more relational. It usually has, you know, human beings and how we interpret things. And then we have these fact truths that you are talking about as the object of historical or journalistic endeavors. Whenever you're dealing with history, though, this would be a question to not maybe dive too far into this question of how we know, but it seems like historical and journalistic endeavors aren't the same thing, though, as like science, which is these repeatable experiments that you can get the same phenomenon over and over again. It's almost like there's the process, what we mean by truth. I'm just testing this. You can tell me what you think. But like as a journalist, it's almost like, and as these peer reviews with Karen King, it's like what counts as historical truth is the outcome of this pretty sophisticated process that we've developed over many, many years, in some cases centuries. And what we mean by truth is the outcome that can keep changing as we put new things through this process. But the process is extremely crucial and almost inextricable from what we mean by truth. And so It seems like Karen didn't follow the process. And so it makes dubious the outcome. You can be accidentally right, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily true in this sort of process-oriented way. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think really that's where you want to place the focus is you know, are the established the processes established by your field, you know, whether it's as a journalist or a historian, which Dr. Karen King is. Do you follow have this sort of time-tested process of like investigating sources, judging the credibility of evidence, using all the various tools at your disposal to investigate? Did you follow the process? And then if you follow the process and you get it wrong, it happens to all of us. Then you go back and you try again. But where the process has been, I think what happened in this case is that there were places where the process wasn't adhered to, and there was corner cutting, and there was a little bit too much speed. And I mean, there was no reason, for instance, Dr. King couldn't have waited, you know, another few months to announce this. She attends, and her colleagues attend, many biblical studies conferences, but she really wanted to announce this at the Coptic conference, which in this year happened to be in Rome.
You know, but the question is why, though? I mean, I'm asking somewhat rhetorically, because from where I sit, and by the way, this goes beyond Dr. Karen King. This is like an issue, I think, in the humanities in scholarship. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, I could interpret what she did not on the basis of an ideology, a postmodern ideology, just a territorialism. Like, if I don't do this, somebody else is going to get wind of it and they're going to publish it first. And this might be because nothing new happens in this field. Mm-hmm. Nothing new happens. I mean, I'm a biblical scholar. We just keep taking the same pieces and maneuvering around a little bit. But if you have this, the only thing new is what you find in the ground, you know, whether it's a manuscript or a building or a statue or a piece of pottery or something. And, you know, you can get carried away, you know, hopeful that you've got something actually new that can make a mark in the field. And maybe you're sort of blinded to that. I mean, the process that Jared's talking about, you're blinded to that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, journalists worry about this all the time. It's called getting scooped, and no one likes getting scooped.
Right.
I don't think in this case that Dr. King worried about getting scooped. I mean, she was the only one who had possession of it. And it wasn't so much that she worried that someone else would have it. I think that the collector, who I imagine we'll talk about in a little bit, the collector was very, very happy that Harvard was going to be the sort of launching pad, or, you know, the rocket ship launching pad for this little fragment, because there's no university that's going to get more media attention than Harvard. And so there wasn't an issue of him sort of like snatching it back from her and saying, no, if you wait a few months, I'm going to give it to Princeton or something, or I'm going to give it to, you know, some little college that you've never heard of. I think he was very pleased and would have waited as long as necessary. Mm-hmm. I think in this case, you know, I'm not really sure. I mean, I'd really like to leave it to readers to sort of parse the evidence in the book. And I'm careful not to. I think we can never really look, you know, into someone else's heart or into their soul. You know, we gather a certain amount of evidence in what's happening in their environment and about, you know, who they are as people, what their values are. And then I think it's really, I want readers to have that sense of discovery and to sort of make those judgments for themselves. Like, what might have motivated Dr. King to sort of move maybe a little too quickly on this, to override maybe even her better judgment, when so much of her scholarship in the past had not been the subject of this kind of scrutiny?
Yeah, so, and not to get too far afield, but have you, you know, I can just see so many lessons here for, I think I mentioned this already as we've been talking, but, you know, in our modern day, and when we think about truth, we think we can just kind of Google something or watch a YouTube video and come to the truth of it because it, quote, makes sense to us. And I just, reading through your book and flipping through it and kind of getting the pieces, I just kept thinking, like, there are these established processes for truth finding. And, you know, what would you say to everyday people? Like, do you know of, like, tools or resources from a journalist perspective? Like, if you want to think like a journalist and understand what it is to get truth in our field, what's something that everyday people could maybe learn? Because I think we could all get some of these tools.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest. I think it's the sort of tools that a lot of us learn in, you know, even in grade school, which is you have to have evidence and you have to have corroboration. So it's not enough to simply have one person tell you something, or to have, you know, to take the word of, in this case, the collector who presented Karen King with the papyrus. He told her a story about where it came from, which she never investigated. And I think that, you know, you have to have, and this is true of good journalism, and the best newspapers do this every day, which is why it sickens me when people use the term fake news, because the best journalists, and I think most journalists, follow these sorts of protocols, which is if someone comes to you with a sensational claim, you have to vet it, which means you have to find out whether you can corroborate it with other people, whether you can corroborate it with other sources. You have to leave the office. You can't just sort of Google it. You have to go to archives. You have to knock on doors. You know, if you're able to knock on doors, call people up and make sure that there's like multiple overlapping confirming evidence from if possible, from living people. So it's easy to tell a lie and get people really excited about something that they've always wanted to be true. So you have to almost resist that. Like when someone comes to you with something like, "Oh my God, this is perfect. This is exactly what I've been saying my whole life." That's precisely the moment where, in the back of your head, you should be going, "Wait a second, I'm really excited about this. Give me, you know, I need to just take a breather here, sleep on it, and now I need to sort of go back to the process." And that process has to be confirmation, validation, documents, evidence, multiple overlapping pieces of evidence for the claim that one is going to sort of put into the world.
So going back, you talked about the forger in this case. We didn't talk a lot about that character, but maybe say a little bit about that. But maybe I'd be curious if you could end that with, What were some of the things that maybe Karen could have done or even learned from a journalist to help her figure out earlier on that this was a forgery?
Yeah, to not do that.
To not even go down that road.
And I won't even, I think this is, goes really much, much beyond Dr. King.
Right.
There is now exactly. sort of a, yeah. an, awake, there's a, an awakening in the field of biblical studies and in archaeology. Archaeology was probably way ahead of everybody else. And papyrology, which is the study of papyri, that provenance matters. That if you don't know where this a manuscript or an object comes from, then you can be in trouble on multiple fronts. Number one, it could be looted. You know, it could be stolen from a place like Iraq or Egypt. And this is the trouble that the Green family got in trouble. The Green family, mm-hmm. the Hobby Lobby family. Has gotten into plenty of trouble with it at the Museum of the Bible, where they simply did not ask the kinds of hard questions about where are these artifacts coming from that we're going to be putting in our museum. This is an evangelical family. You know, this is not sort of, these scammers don't play favorites. They don't care if you're, you know, a patriarchal, evangelical billionaire or a progressive Harvard scholar. They will seek out the thing that you always want to be true, and they will seek to have you acquire it or make it famous. So I just want to make that clear. Like this is not about liberal, conservative, evangelical, yep. atheist. Any one of us could fall victim to these scams. So the question is provenance, chain of ownership. You have to. What scholars are learning is that they have to be able to go back and spend time understanding how the document, how the new sculpture, how the inscription, how the ossuary that you've been given, who trace that back to the moment it came out of the ground, if you can. Who are the previous owners? When and how did it exchange hands? And it's not enough to just say, oh, a collector gave me a letter from a previous owner and it says that he owned it. That's not enough. You need to make phone calls. You need to go out into the world. You need to look for other forms of documentation. When all of your information about provenance comes from a single source and that source is vested in having you believe something is true, that's not a good source. It's not a sufficient source. So I think the biggest takeaway, and that scholars were already thinking about this, but it's now, I think, post-Gospel of Jesus' Wife, it's something that they're thinking about in really serious ways, and they're way smarter people than me on this who are discussing this. But how do we make sure that we know the origin of the manuscripts and the sensational objects that are coming our way in a field which, as you just said, is pretty picked over. There are a finite number of texts. People can pick them over, and they do. And they're you know, I attended the Society for Biblical Literature. It's the largest annual conference of biblical scholars in the world. It attracts 10,000 scholars every year, and they're all picking over a relatively small number of texts. So when a new one comes along, it is extremely exciting. And you know, for instance, the Gospel of Judas came along a few years. That is an authentic, non-canonical text that generated a lot of excitement. That one happened to be authentic, and it was a big deal for that reason. But to get back to your point, I think the real takeaway is provenance matters.
It seems so obvious, too. Just if you think about it, I'm like, it's like a more intense version of, hey, I have this this outfit from an Elton John concert in the 70s. Like, you would want to trace it back and sort of figure out how would we know that that's actually where it came from. So it's just more intense than that. It makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, Ariel, listen, thank you so much for joining us today. I mean, this is a fascinating book, and have we even talked about the title yet? What's this book that you wrote?
Oh, sure. The book is called Veritas.
The people want to know. Yeah, Veritas. Yeah.
Well, Veritas, the Veritas, a Harvard professor, a con man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. And, you know, Veritas,
and Veritas Veritas is tied to Harvard.
It's the Harvard motto. I think it goes back to 1643. But it's not just sort of a casual, sort of gimmicky allusion to the Harvard name. It actually sort of undergirds the sort of the biggest, what I see as the biggest theme in the book, which is how do different people go about truth seeking, and we haven't talked about the mystery man who who presented this fragment to Karen King. But a good deal of the book concerns my sort of shoe leather investigation into who this gentleman is, his backstory, and I hope that readers really find that to be kind of a gripping detective story, because he's an absolutely fascinating figure.
Yeah, we may, in the intro, we may add that little description you gave us just to tantalize people, because I'm disappointed we don't have time to get into it. It's super interesting.
No. Well, that's it. And, you know, we don't need to give away all the spoilers, right?
So exactly.
That's right. Make them buy it. Make them buy it. No problem. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, is there a way people can find you online if they want to connect more or keep following your writings as you have other things that come out?
Yeah, sure. So my website is www.arielsabar.com. So that's my name is spelled A-R-I-E-L-S-A-B-A-R. You know, I'm on Twitter as well as at Ariel Sabar and on Facebook. But the website's a really great way to keep up with what's going on and with the book and with other magazine stories that I write from time to time.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was just a topic that it took a different slant than our normal topics, but it's so relevant to what we talk about every week on the podcast. So thank you so much.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Ariel. Appreciate it. All right, normal people, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you have a chance again, pick up Ariel Sabar's book, Veritas, A Harvard Professor, A Con Man, and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Good read.
And you know what? Before you go, we just wanted to remind you, and maybe we're just coming to this on our own. We're coming into our own here and recognizing at the end of the day, the Bible for Normal People is more than a podcast. We have at least 100, maybe 150 videos now up on Patreon that explores all kinds of questions related to the things that we talk about here on the podcast. So Pete, myself, are putting up videos every week. So that in itself is worth maybe a visit to Patreon. So go to patreon.com/thebiblefornormalpeople. Where you can check out those videos. We also have a Slack group with several hundred people who are talking about the impact of these kinds of questions on their everyday life and what it means for church and belonging and community.
Learn a lot from that Slack group.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got some really, really nice, smart people, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
We also sell baked goods. You didn't mention that.
We do not sell baked goods. That's false advertising.
Oh, I thought we were going
to.
Okay.
No.
I read that wrong. I read the memo wrong.
We could maybe
sell merchandise.
We can sell more. Yeah, we do sell merchandise. Yeah.
Awesome t-shirts and onesies.
But just go to patreon.com/thebibleformalpeople where you can find more about how to connect with the community here at The Bible for Normal People.
All right, folks. See ya.
Thanks as always to our team. Producer Megan Kamick, audio engineer Dave Gerhart, creative director Tessa Stoltz, marketing and administration Reed Lively, and transcriptionist Stephanie Spate. For Pete, Jared, and the entire Bible for Normal People team, thanks for listening.